Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, January 18th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. A brief scare in heavily fortified downtown Washington, D.C. ahead of Wednesday's presidential inauguration. Loudspeaker announcements on the west front of the U.S. Capitol warning of an external security threat and officials yelling, "This is not a drill." Participants in an inauguration rehearsal evacuated. Turns out it was a fire under a bridge a few blocks away, the all-clear given soon after. On this Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday, President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris taking part in a day of service, volunteering at hunger relief organizations. Biden in Philadelphia, Harris in Washington, D.C., and both calling on Americans to do the same. Kamala Harris resigning as U.S. Senator from California ahead of her becoming vice president. And also then the tie-breaking vote in a Senate evenly split Democratic and Republican. She writes in the San Francisco Chronicle that she hopes there will not be many times that she has to break tie votes, but writes, quotes, "The Senate will instead find common ground and do the work of the American people." And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi raising concerns about a former White House official and Donald Trump loyalist, Michael Ellis, being installed as general counsel at the National Security Agency. Pelosi sending a letter to Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller demanding that Ellis not be put in that position, calling him unfit for the job. The U.S. Capitol complex temporarily locked down Monday during a rehearsal for Vice President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, writes the Associated Press, after a fire in a homeless encampment roughly a mile away sent a plume of smoke into the air and caused security concerns in an already jittery city. This is what it sounded like, as posted by Jackson Prosco, Washington bureau chief with Canada's Global Television Network.
Everyone's running from the Capitol grounds.
More from the Associated Press story. Law enforcement officials said there was no threat to the public and the fire was not believed to be a threat to the inauguration. The evacuation of some participants and the lockdown were ordered by the acting chief of Capitol Police in an abundance of caution, officials said. After that, the inauguration rehearsal got back underway.
Ladies and gentlemen, accompanying the vice president-elect, the acting deputy house sergeant-at-arms, Kevin Groves, and the acting deputy sergeant, Senate sergeant-at-arms, United States Capitol Police Officer, Eugene Goodman.
Joining us now with more on inauguration security is Washington Post national security reporter Dan LaMoth. Thanks very much for being with us. Let's start with today's incident. A fire blocks away from the U.S. Capitol building turned out not to be a problem, but there are pictures, a video of the military band in the inauguration rehearsal running with their instruments into the West Front. Kind of shows how on edge everyone is.
Yeah, I think in this case, it's a good example of how tense things are. And you know, this appears to have been a fire in a homeless encampment. So a sad situation, but completely unrelated to all of the recent threats.
The story that you had over the weekend, concerns about insider threats in the U.S. troops stationed in Washington, D.C. What did you find there?
Yes, as we look at the events on the 6th, one of the things that have come out of that is concerns from lawmakers and others about where the individual service member might be on a situation like this. A number of veterans and at least one or two current serving, I believe there's a National Guardsman and an Army Reservist, were arrested as a result of the events on the 6th. So there is, at this point, additional screening that has been put in place. DOD often would probably be looking at this on a sort of a unit level of, you know, there being some accountability and the hope that commanders are watching their own personnel. But in this case, they're also submitting names to the FBI, and the FBI will be screening for any kind of, extremist tendencies or any kind of criminal behavior, anything that might have gone under the radar to make sure that they're confident in the people they have there.
Other than an insider threat, what are the police and the military most worried about?
I would say that it's several fold. I think there are concerns of sort of the big, terror type of threat that might come out of this. I think today is a good example of there being concerns that something that's relatively insignificant can be, lead to pretty fast moving consequences. And you're always concerned about, does that lead to an overcorrection or, just some sort of military response that, is inappropriate for the situation as well.
Last week, the FBI sent out a bulletin to all 50 state governments warning about extremists planning violence at state capitals starting on January 16th. Have we seen anything yet?
We've seen small gatherings in multiple capitals. Lansing, Michigan comes to mind, where you've seen groups of relatively heavily armed people. But the events have been largely peaceful. There haven't been sort of the big ugly events that we saw not only on the 6th, but in some of the state capitals earlier in 2020 as well. So far, so good on that front.
What is it like getting around Washington, D.C. now? Have you tried?
I have. I interviewed Major General Walker, the commander of the D.C. National Guard, on Saturday in front of the Armory. And kind of just due diligence, drove around to the extent I could on sort of the eastern side of the Capitol. And, just to get within a few blocks of the building, yes, I needed to show a press badge. And it was basically down to even as far away as the Library of Congress, several blocks from the Capitol. That's pretty much the edge of the red zone, they're calling it. And then there's that additional area outside they're calling the green zone. I mean, really, if you don't live in that area, they're kind of discouraging any kind of activity there.
We talk about how the city is on edge. We've heard about a couple of arrests at these checkpoints. Is there any information about how the police and the National Guard have responded to some potential threats?
I think largely so far, these events have come up on a case-by-case basis. There was one event Saturday with a man from Virginia. The initial report sounded rather concerning. He comes into town, a pistol in the vehicle. He doesn't have the right credential. He's got hundreds of rounds of ammunition in the vehicle. As it turns out, that event, he was there as private security, had a badge, but the wrong badge. He was not licensed to bring the weapon into the city, so that was a legitimate charge, apparently. But it wasn't the initial concern of, some sort of sympathizer with the events on the 6th. It turned out to be, I think, largely a mistake, and we're still waiting for that to come out in the wash.
We're talking with Dan Lamothe, Washington Post national security reporter. We're all focused on the inauguration, getting through that, and the security lockdown has been really tight. But looking ahead, sort of similar to what happened after the 9/11 attacks, do you see any security changes that have been put in place that will not go away after this inauguration?
I think it's going to be important to watch and get an understanding of how this might be rolled back. One of the things that General Walker told me on Saturday is don't expect 25,000 National Guardsmen to disappear overnight either. The sense is there that they're going to kind of, they gradually ramped up. They're in the neighborhood of about 21,000 today with the expectation of 25,000 by tomorrow night. But on the flip side of this, they will also gradually come down. So, what the security looks like a day or three or five from now, I would imagine some of these fences are going to come down and some of these streets are going to come, are going to open again. But we're waiting to see what the sum total of the security looks like on, for the sake of argument, February 1st or some date when you're supposedly in a steady state again.
Washington Post national security reporter Dan Lamothe. Read more at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Politico is reporting that the Pentagon has authorized 750 active duty personnel to include members with expertise in handling chemical, biological, nuclear, radiological, and explosive weapons, as well as explosive ordnance disposal and medical teams skilled in trauma response to help out with the inauguration security. That, according to someone, a defense official, speaking on condition of anonymity to Politico. Also today, the Presidential Inaugural Committee announcing that the inaugural parade, largely virtual due to the coronavirus pandemic, will be hosted by actor Tony Goldwyn, who played a fictional president on the ABC series Scandal. And those taking part in the parade, comedian Jon Stewart, musical acts New Radicals, Earth, Wind & Fire, Nile Rodgers, Kathy Sledge, and Andra Day. Also Olympic athletes Nathan Chen, Allison Felix, and Katie Ledecky. Plus the University of Delaware Drumline and the Howard University Drumline, both the alma maters of President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. On this Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday, the President-elect and incoming First Lady Jill Biden volunteering at the largest hunger relief organization in Philadelphia. It's called Philabundance. And Vice President-elect Harris and her husband Doug Emhoff did the same at Martha's Table, a food bank and service organization in Washington, D.C. The Vice President-elect spoke to reporters after.
We're here at Martha's Table to support the work that is happening. The volunteers are here. There are a number of high school students from Jack and Jill who are here in honor of the Day of Service, where we recognize and pay tribute to the work of Dr. King. I think it's so important to remember that Dr. King was killed in large part, I believe, because he was on the verge of bringing together the civil rights movement around racial justice with the fight for economic justice. And when we look at where we are as a country today, when we look at recent events, we know that the fight that Dr. King was engaged in is still a fight in America, which is to recognize the connection and to recognize our collective responsibility to address these injustices. Today in America, 1 in 6 families is describing their household as being hungry. Today in America, 1 in 5 is describing an inability to pay rent. 1 in 3 is describing an inability to pay their bills. So we are here today as part of what we collectively, all of us who are volunteering, see as our responsibility as part of Dr. King's legacy. And we're here to obviously renew the commitment that we should each have to service and to serve others, especially those in need. So thank you all for being here. Myself and saying that we're going into Wednesday knowing that we're ready to do the work. And we've got a lot of work to do. It's not going to be easy. As we have discussed, Joe has outlined our plan for vaccinations, our plan for recovery, and in particular relief for working people, for families. And there is a lot to do. Some would say that ours is an ambitious goal, but we do believe with hard work and with the cooperation and collaboration of the members of the United States Congress that we can get it done.
One more. You outlined some hardships that Americans face today. Do you think that the one-time $1,400 direct payments that are being proposed in some policy, do you think that that's enough for Americans today?
It's a start. There's a lot more to do, which is why there's so many other components to our relief package and the work that we are committed to doing going forward. Yeah. Looking forward to be sworn in as the next Vice President of the United States, and I will walk there to that moment proudly with my head up and my shoulder back.
Thank you guys so much.
Vice President-elect Kamala Harris today in Washington. President-elect Donald Trump put out a statement on Friday proclaiming the Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday, and he wrote in part, It is clear now more than ever before that we can no longer allow the American dream to be deferred for Black Americans. However, in this march toward equality, we cannot permit any creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. As a student of nonviolence, Dr. King called on us not to satisfy the thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. Former President Barack Obama tweeted today, "If anyone had a right to question whether our democracy was worth redeeming, it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Because in the face of billy clubs and lynchings, poll taxes and literacy tests, he never gave in to violence, never waved a traitorous flag, or gave up on our country." Vice President Mike Pence, First Lady Melania Trump, and White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany also all tweeting praise for Dr. King and his legacy today. President-elect Joe Biden posted a video on Sunday.
Dr. King once said, "Everyone can be great because everyone can serve." It's one of his many lessons that endures today and that we've seen throughout this pandemic. From sewing masks to dropping off groceries to their elderly neighbors, Americans across the country know that service, looking out for one another, is part of who we are as a nation. And it's why, during the inaugural week, my family and I will be joining the National Day of Service on Dr. Martin Luther King Day. On January 18th, 2021, we'll be partnering with organizations across the country to organize service events focused on COVID-19 relief efforts. We hope you can help. Consider what your community needs and reach out to your friends to get them involved. For example, you can collect jackets from your neighbors and drop them off at shelters, fill a virtual shopping cart for a food pantry, or join virtual events to write cards of thanks to first responders. To find out more, go to BidenInaugural.org/service to learn how to get involved and commit to serving your country on Dr. King Day of Service during Inaugural Week. Service is a fitting way to start to heal, unite, and rebuild this country we love. I hope you can join us. And thank you, and I wish you and your families much love and much hope for the new year.
President-elect Joe Biden tweeted video. This is Washington Today. We're getting some hints at what the very earliest major policy changes from the Biden-Harris administration will be. One of them involves the Keystone XL oil pipeline. Joining us now with more is Politico energy reporter Ben Lefebvre. Thanks for being with us. What have you learned?
Thank you. We've learned that Biden, President-elect Biden, who had said last year during his campaigning that he would rescind the permit that would make the Keystone XL permit pipeline a reality, that they're going to do this on day one, on Wednesday, after he's inaugurated. The Biden administration is expected to come out with a flurry of executive orders, rolling back some of the Trump administration's own rollbacks. And among them will be a rescinding of the cross-border permit that was needed for the pipeline to cross from Canada into the United States.
So this can be done by executive order. Any way Congress could get involved or the courts?
No, and it's interesting. When the pipeline was first kind of proposed, the company needed what you call a presidential permit. That's the permit that allows it to cross the border into the U.S. And the State Department was in charge of kind of reviewing the pipeline, making sure you know basically listing its environmental impacts. But what the Trump administration did is, after trying to have the State Department reverse the decision that it had made under Obama, the Trump administration basically said, "We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to have the White House issue the presidential permit." So basically took out any sort of bureaucratic input into where this, you know, how this pipeline would work. So in a way, the Trump administration actually made it easier for the incoming Biden administration to reverse the intent and just say, "Well, you guys went with a presidential permit signed by the actual president. We're going to rescind it just by the actual president." So Congress doesn't really have too much role in this. It didn't have much role in the beginning, and now it's narrowed even further into just basically who's in the Oval Office can make the decision.
Well, the environmental community will obviously be happy about this. Who's going to be upset?
The oil and gas industry, especially in Canada. Canada's had a hard time moving its crude oil to areas where it can go out for export. And it had hoped to move a lot of the oil coming out of Western Canada to the U.S., where it would be used by refineries and then could go further to the Gulf Coast for export to China or other countries who may want it. But that's not going to happen now. Canada's had a really hard time moving this oil, which for a variety of reasons is just considered more environmentally damaging than, you know, the stuff that comes out of North Dakota or Texas even. The other ones who are not happy about the decision is basically the Canadian government. They actually took a stake in Keystone XL to kind of help move it along when it looked like investors would shy away from it. So, you know, this had come as something that the Canadian government is still basically trying to convince the incoming Biden administration to, you know, think again on. And some unions have come out and said that they were looking forward to some of the temporary jobs that building the pipeline would have created, though there's still questions about, you know, the estimates of how many jobs it actually would have been.
What is the status of this project? Is any of it built yet?
Yeah, yes and no. TransCanada, the company that was backing this project, had originally designed this this pipeline to go from Western Canada to kind of making a stop of sorts in the Midwest, and then by another project linked down to the Gulf Coast. They actually built part of the pipeline that goes from Cushing, Oklahoma to the Gulf Coast to deliver oil. And they've built a little bit, like maybe 100 miles or so of the pipeline that started in, just on the U.S. side of the border from Montana, maybe 100 miles or so. But that's about as far as they got. This project was first proposed in 2008. I mean, it's been on the drawing board forever. But I would say no more than a couple hundred miles or so has actually been built in all that time.
We're talking with Ben LaFave with Politico. And finally, the incoming White House Chief of Staff for President Biden, Ron Klain, put out a memo over the weekend with expected first-day executive orders and actions. This was not on the list. Do we have any idea why?
No, and that's something that caused a bit of confusion. It almost seems like there's two lists going around. One was the one you mentioned that specifically did not have Keystone on the on that list. But a second presentation that did go around did have it on there. From what I've heard from some sources and my colleague as well heard, was that there may have been two timelines being considered. And, you know, there may have been some pushback from some of the unions or some of the, you know, Canadian government officials trying kind of, you know, can we, you know, postpone this death sentence a little bit, as one source put it. But I think in the end, the Biden administration said, no, we promised to do this. There's no real point in delaying us rescinding the permit. We're just going to do it now. I mean, my own thought, and this, you know, I can't say this is coming from anybody but myself, was that maybe they thought, well, look, we know the Canadian government, you know, is going to be antagonized by this move. Let's do it on Wednesday with the other, you know, included in the other flurry of executive orders that may be going out. And therefore, we can maybe antagonize them a little less because the move will be buried by other news as well.
Ben LaFave, Politico energy reporter. Read more at politico.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Washington Today. Turning to the coronavirus pandemic, the World Health Organization says the response to the COVID-19 outbreak has been slow and ineffective. A panel report put out today. COVID so far infecting more than 95 million people worldwide, killing more than 2 million. And when it comes to vaccines, the director general of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, is criticizing the distribution priority so far, saying it is not right that younger, healthier adults in wealthy countries are getting vaccinated before older people or healthcare workers in poorer countries. Here's the director general.
More than 39 million doses of vaccine have now been administered in at least 49 higher income countries. Just 25 doses have been given in one lowest income country. Not 25 million, not 25,000, just 25. I need to be blunt. The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure. And the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries. Even as they speak the language of equitable access, some countries and companies continue to prioritize bilateral deals, going around COVAX, driving up prices, and attempting to jump to the front of the queue. This is wrong. 44 bilateral deals were signed last year, and at least 12 have already been signed this year. The situation is compounded by the fact that most manufacturers have prioritized regulatory approval in rich countries where the profits are highest, rather than submitting full dossiers to WHO. This could delay COVAX deliveries and create exactly the scenario COVAX was designed to avoid, with hoarding, a chaotic market, an uncoordinated response, and continued social and economic disruption.
Dr. Tedros is the leader of the WHO World Health Organization at an executive board meeting held virtually from its headquarters in Geneva today. Coronavirus numbers in the U.S. now over 24 million cases and closing in on 400,000 deaths. According to Johns Hopkins University data, it took the U.S. 304 days to reach the first 12 million cases and just 59 days to reach the next 12 million cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the top federal infectious disease expert. He was asked today when life could get back to normal. He was taking part in the Choose Health Life Black Clergy Conclave. So normal in this case included specifically when church services would look like the pre-pandemic version, loud praising and singing included.
I would project that if we do it appropriately, effectively, and efficiently, that by the time we get to the end of the summer, the beginning of the fall, if we do get that group vaccinated, I think in the fall, mid-fall, we'll be able to get back to that type of worship which we all are longing for right now.
Amen. Dr. Fauci, a follow-up to that and the absolute final question. If you have been vaccinated, can you still spread the disease, and do you need to wear a mask?
You know, the answer to that is yes, it is possible that you can. We don't know the precise answer, Deborah, because we're going to have to continue to do studies. But the primary endpoint of the study was to protect you from clinically recognizable disease. That was the 94 to 95% efficacy. What could happen is that you could be protected from clinically recognizable disease, still get infected, not know it, be perfectly fine with regard to symptoms, but yet have in your nasal pharynx a degree of virus that you might be able to spread to other people. And for that reason, we say continue to wear a mask. As we learn more about this, Deborah, we'll know whether the vaccine makes that level of virus so low that you won't be able to transmit it. If it is, then we could pull back on some of the public health measures. But right now, we don't know that. So we need to move on the facts as we know it, which means you want to wear a mask.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. No Wall Street trading on this federal holiday. China is reporting its economy grew 2.3% in 2020, likely the only major economy to expand. Some other headlines, President-elect Biden expected to nominate Rohit Chopra as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's a former deputy director. Associated Press calls him a progressive ally of Senator Elizabeth Warren. Biden also planning to nominate Gary Gensler to chair the SEC, Security and Exchange Commission. He's a former chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and former Goldman Sachs banker. And the director of the Census Bureau, Stephen Dillingham, is resigning effective Wednesday, he said in a message to Bureau staff today. Hill newspaper reports Dillingham faced scrutiny from Democrats and other critics for allegedly succumbing to efforts by the Trump administration to politicize the census. And finally, First Lady Melania Trump, who will leave the White House on Wednesday along with the president, today tweeted a farewell video. She thanked law enforcement for keeping communities safe, also gave a special thanks to U.S. military and their families, and spoke of her signature Best Be Best initiative.
As I say farewell to my role as First Lady, it is my sincere hope that every American will do their part to teach our children what it means to be best. I encourage parents to educate your children about the courageous and selfless heroes who worked and sacrificed to make this country the land of the free, and to lead by example and care for others in your community. The promise of this nation belongs to all of us. Do not lose sight of your integrity and values. Use every opportunity to show consideration for another person and build good habits into your daily lives. In all circumstances, I ask every American to be an ambassador of Be Best, to focus on what unites us, to raise above what divides us, to always choose love over hatred, peace over violence, and others before yourself. Together, as one national family, we can continue to be the light of hope for future generations and carry on America's legacy of rising our nation to greater heights through our spirit of courage, goodness, and faith. No words can express the depth of my gratitude for the privilege of having served as your First Lady. To all the people of this country, you will be in my heart forever. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
Last few minutes of today's video tweeted by First Lady Melania Trump. Journalist and author Kate Anderson Brower writes an opinion piece at CNN that begins, understandably lost in the morass of the horrifying things that have happened leading up to Joe Biden's inauguration, is something that did not happen. Melania Trump will become the first modern First Lady not to invite the woman who will replace her to the White House for a walkthrough of the private living quarters on the second and third floor. Read more at CNN.com. And thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN Radio app. And remember, this program and others from C-SPAN available as podcasts. Find them wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hope you have a good evening.